Thank you, Allison and Christine, for having me here. Thank you, everyone, for being trapped in this room and having to listen to me for 20 minutes. I'm going to talk today about transgender educational efforts and how they've changed over the past 50 or 60 years. I'll argue that as the community formed, interactions were primarily personal, that we moved to a sort of corporate top-down policy with large large for our community organizations. And then in recent years, because of technology, we've moved back towards the personal again, and that in a community as small as ours, compared to many other communities, that's a good thing.
We're waiting for the technology.
Technology is wonderful, except when it isn't. Last year when I was at the Grand Prix, is there a clicker for this, or are you the clicker?
I'm the clicker.
Okay. So, Nick, we can have the next slide. Okay, next slide. Does anyone recognize these miscreants? Bolton and Park. The next slide is an actual photograph of them. They found themselves in the Victorian newspapers. It was quite a big scandal because of a relationship they had with some lord or other in England. Transgendered and transgender people have always found one another somehow. Next slide. Reviews, cabarets, drag shows were one way transgender people came together in the early part of the 20th century. Next slide. Next slide. And somehow they found family there. Next slide shows a group of people out for dinner. But by coming together in clubs, people were able to have human interaction with one another to get information. But there was certainly no sort of concerted way of doing gender education. Most transgender people went it entirely alone. I love this picture. I bought it on eBay for like $6. But you wonder, like, what is this person's story? Next slide. Or this person's story. Next slide. And next slide. This is someone who comes to a lot of conferences. I was sort of hoping she would be here today. Next slide. That's Billie Henning. That was a picture she took in 1956 when she was young and managed to take a picture of herself with her camera. It wasn't until the 1950s, until the sixth decade of the 20th century, that things began to change that set the foundation for the community we have today. First, small groups of cross-dressers began to meet in California and New York State. Next. And second, Christine Jorgensen, an American XGI, went abroad and came back abroad. Next slide. The news was so sensational it knocked the H-bomb off the first front page of all the papers around the country. So we're going to follow these two and separate branches of the trans community as they evolve separately for maybe 20 years before they come back together in the mid-80s. And we're going to start with the cross-dresser branch. Someone tell me who the person in the middle is?
Virginia Prince.
That is the one and only Virginia Prince. In the 50s, she became the figurative head of the fledgling cross-dresser movement. She founded a number of organizations, some of which are still in existence today. The most important is TRIAS, the Society for the Second Self. That came about as a result of one of Virginia's considerable number of organizations, and Carol B. Cross Manzel. By the 70s, TRIAS was publicizing itself in print media and on TV, publishing newsletters, attempting to reach and offer comfort to heterosexual crossdressers. Eventually, TRIAS would have 40 or more chapters across the United States. In the 50s also, Virginia began to publish the magazine Transvestia, which featured not only photos and mildly erotic crossdressing fiction, but thought-provoking essays and letters to the editor. In the various issues, Virginia laid out her philosophy of heterosexual cross-dressing, much as, and about the same time as Hugh Hefner was laying out a philosophy of personal freedom in his Playboy magazine. Next. Tri-S, Transvestia, and early transgender conferences like Dream on the West Coast and Fantasia Fair on the East Coast played important roles in the growth of this cross-dressing community. Now let's look at the second prong, the transsexual prong. Christine Jorgensen's wasn't the first sex reassignment. There were a number of others, but the notoriety that surrounded her case had a huge effect. The notion that it was possible to change one's sex stunned the world, scientists included, and Jorgensen's transition provided a roadmap to thousands of men and women who felt much like her and now saw a way clear to acting on their feelings. Soon they were finding their way to endocrinologists like Dr. Harry Benjamin in New York and to Casablanca for sex reassignment by Dr. George Beru. Next slide. In 1966, Harry Benjamin published his magnum opus, The Transsexual Phenomenon. In it, he defined transsexualism as a mental disorder and argued that since there was no cure, it was in the best interest of both transsexuals and of greater society to alleviate the intense suffering of transsexuals by, in selected cases, sex reassignment. Back to Benjamin's book. Now, Benjamin was a compassionate man. I have no idea if he really believed transsexualism was a mental illness, but certainly considered the era. He packaged in that book transsexualism in the only conceivable way that would have justified hormonal and surgical treatment. I don't think anything else would have worked. So it was, as it were, a necessary medicalization, but he was a wonderful man and he did a great thing, but at the same time, medicalization was and still is an albatross hung around all of our necks. Okay, now next. With Benjamin having laid the theoretical rationale for sex reassignment, it fell to this psychologist, who knows who that is, that's John Money, and this psychiatrist, who was then very young, Richard Green, to publish a multidisciplinary journal to describe the nuts and bolts, as it were, of sex reassignment. It was a multidisciplinary volume with chapters on hormonal therapy, surgery, voice, electrolysis, grooming, employment, religion, the whole shebang. Next slide. Published in 1969, the book was called Transsexualism and Sex Reassignment. My copy of that book is in Ann Arbor with the rest of my collection, which was donated in 2000 as part of the Gender Education and Advocacy Collection, so I didn't have a picture of it. So I'm going to show you a picture of my book, Current Concepts in Transgender Identity, which was published some 30 years later, and which included contributions by three of the original contributors to transsexualism and sex reassignment, which were Drs. Green, Dr. Money, and Dr. Ira Polly. Next slide. So we have this book. It's essentially an operating manual for running a gender program, and that's Johns Hopkins University. Next clipping. In 1966, a gender clinic was opened at Johns Hopkins, the first in the United States, for hormonal and sexual reassignment of transsexuals. It served as a model. I mean, this is the most prestigious medical school in the United States. Soon as many as 40 gender clinics were scattered throughout the United States. Next slide. This is an article I wrote in 1993, criticizing the clinics. They provided sex reassignment for very few people. The vast majority of people, including myself, were turned away as unsuitable for one reason or the other. One of the things patients had to do was conform to Rambo Bimbo standards of masculinity and femininity. If you weren't an absolute sexual stereotype, you were turned away. I mean, one of the clinics was quoted in Wendy Kessler and Suzanne McKenna's book, Gender and Ethno-Methodological Approach, as saying, if this male-to-female transsexual doesn't turn me on and make me feel as a woman makes a man feel, then clearly she's not a candidate for sex reassignment. That's how sexist they were. Next slide. The clinics ran until 1979, when a scheme orchestrated by this man, I have no idea how that word got on that slide, Dr. Paul McHugh, who announced in a 1993 article in American Scholar magazine that one of his reasons for taking the chair of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins was to shut down the gender clinic. And he managed to do that by introducing a bogus paper into the scientific literature that showed, quote unquote, no objective advantage for sex reassignment in male to female transsexuals. This resulted in the closing within about a year of not only the Hopkins program, but of every gender clinic in the United States. A couple converted to for-profit status, and the clinic at the University of Minnesota became a non-surgical program. All the others disappeared. And so the transsexual prong comes to an ignominious end. The closing of the gender clinics was actually of tremendous benefit to transgender people. In fact, I wrote a letter to McHugh thanking him for that bogus paper because it really sparked the formation of the transgender community. And I wrote him as of the mid-1990s that because of what he had done, any American with the financial means and the will could now have sex reassignment at their own instigation and not at that of doctors in gender programs. So I thanked him. For some reason, he didn't reply. Why were the gender clinics bad? Well, because their confidentiality requirements silenced transsexuals. They kept them out of contact with other transsexuals and with cross-dressers. No, I'm sorry, I wasn't cueing you back one. Because they advised their patients to disappear because now you're cured, now you're normal, and you tell no one about your past, and most transsexuals did that. They perpetuated harmful and untrue stereotypes about transsexuals like the Rambo Bimbo stuff and talked about transsexuals having all kinds of concurrent mental disorders, which were actually more due to the selection criteria of the clinics than anything about transsexuals themselves. They disempowered transsexuals, depriving them of information, and they enforced a gender binary because with the clinics it was all or nothing. You went all the way or you got no treatment at all. And as I said, it kept transsexuals and cross-dressers out of communication with one another. So now we have these two prongs not communicating with one another. We have transsexuals no longer with clinics to go to, looking for some place. We have a fairly well-established cross-dressing community, and then this happened. This is Winslow Street in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and there during Fantasia Fair, I believe it was during the fair, some people who had been going to the fair met, and they laid out a philosophy and a plan that led to the creation of the Winslow Street Fund and IFGE. This platform allowed us to all come together for the first time, next one, at the IFGE conference. The IFGE's annual conference was the first to aggressively welcome every gender variant person. Transsexuals were unwelcome or at best tolerated at Abigda. Jude Patton, who's sitting here, was one of the first and probably the first transsexual to ever attend the meeting. And after him, there was a period of a good long time when I don't think there were any transsexuals going at all. And the Trias conferences definitely didn't welcome gay cross-dressers and transsexuals. At the IFG conference, everyone was welcome. And the minute everyone got together, guess what happened? We started talking. The BL, next one, Southern Comfort. Pretty soon there was a circuit of conferences around the country where people were talking. There were newsletters like Tapestry, which was IFGE's journal. That's an early copy before the photo covers. There were, and Chrysalis, which I have to watch my gesturing with these papers. Chrysalis was the magazine that I edited in the 90s. This was a controversial cover. I call it Transgender Gothic. That's Grant Wood's American Gothic with Harry Benjamin and Virginia Prince's pictures transposed. I got some heat for that one because I was calling Trias about some of their exclusivity, and they're still angry with me about it. Suddenly we were talking about who we were, and we were finding out that maybe we weren't like we had been told we were by the medical profession. Maybe we weren't damaged. Maybe we were whole. Maybe we weren't sick. Maybe this was just another way of being human to be transgendered. And maybe there wasn't this huge chasm between cross-dressers and transsexuals that everyone had until then believed. Next picture. This is from Benjamin's book. It's the Benjamin Scale, and it's kind of a Likert kind of scale with exclusive masculinity on one side, exclusive femininity on the other side. That was soon replaced with the transgender model, which didn't hold masculinity and femininity as being mutually exclusive. People could have as much masculinity and as much femininity as they happened to have or wanted to have. And whatever you wanted to do with your body and your social role was fine. So if you wanted to cross live without surgery, that wasn't suddenly a no-no. And we had this model that we developed that pictured us as healthy people. And it took us only a few years after those two prongs of the community came together to discard the medical model, to render it obsolete, and have the community. Now, in those heady days, there were a number of large national organizations that were operating. There was the IFGE, which we've talked about. There was FTM International. There was TRIAS. I was running the American Educational Gender Information Service. And out of Philly, we have one of the founders here today, Allison, was Renaissance, which was coming on gangbusters in the late 80s and early 90s. So we have all these very, next picture. We have all of these very, actually small national organizations working really hard on minuscule budgets to do transgender education. And this is our top-down period of transgender education. The personal I talked about from before was largely being supplanted by the top-down stuff. And there was a problem. Because our community is so small, the organizations really couldn't grow. Now, I was running an information service, answering phones, stuffing envelopes, on a budget that was never exceeded more than $25,000 a year, which was spent for printing and stamps and envelopes. And I was pretty much spending every waking hour at no salary while having a full-time job, trying to help people make critical decisions about their lives. And it was running me ragged, and I knew at some level that it couldn't go on, and yet it was critical work, and I couldn't just stop. It was work I had inherited from Jude Patton and Sister Joanne and Sister Mary Elizabeth, who had been running J2CP services, who had taken off from Paul Walker, a psychologist, who had taken over from the Erickson Educational Foundation, which was founded in the 1960s by FTM Reed Erickson, to do educational work about transsexualism. It was critical work. It had been going on for 20 years, and I didn't feel it was ethical or right to stop. And I also didn't want to drop dead in the traces from working so hard. I was looking for a way out. I was an honorable way out. And then Ricky Ann Wilkins happened. Sitting at IFGE in 1993, I believe it was, in Atlanta, there was a leafleting by a transsexual menace, Ricky and a couple of other people. Lynn Walker, I believe, was another one. They leafleted and they complained about IFGE's Vision 2000, which was an imaging of the future and sort of like where's the community going, that Ricky had some problems with. I couldn't make much sense of it myself. A lot of people were offended, but I really saw it kind of as a clarion call for change. So, Chrysalis was the magazine I published. Aegis also had a newsletter, and in the 1996 issues of Aegis News, I did something called Vision 2001, a Gender Odyssey, which was sort of a takeoff of Vision 2000, but I tried to take a snapshot of the community as it existed as of early 1996. This is one of the pages from my article, which shows all of the budgets of the organizations down there around between $8,000 and $25,000, except for Fantasia Fair, which had a larger budget because of the conference. And IFGE, which was up in the stratosphere at more than $300,000, Only one really large organization. Everyone else was just struggling. I think the next slide. No, other way. Yeah. One back one. 2 years later, after I'd been mulling it over for a while, I did a follow-up issue, the fifth issue I dedicated to this, in which I speculated about the future of the transgender community. I said in the first part that I had a growing sense that the community's national organizations were on the verge of unprecedented change of realignment. I said I was impressing and I didn't know what the changes would be or when they would happen or what would happen, but I just felt like things were going to break and things were going to start to happen fast. Now, one of the things that happened was the emergence of the transgender political arm. Suddenly, to compete with the educational organizations, were now two or three national transgender political organizations wanting your money, and quite frankly, were really a lot better at asking for the money than the educational organizations had ever been. Some of the organizations were very slick. I pointed out that by its very nature, our community would likely never reach a point where we could adequately fund even one national organization. You know, we're not going to have any multi-million dollar transgender educational organizations. It's just not going to happen. We seem to be kind of coasting along at our level and not really getting a whole lot bigger. I acknowledge the critical work the national educational organizations had played, but I question whether it outlived their usefulness. And this is what I said. Next one. I said, recently I typed in the word transsexual on a search engine on the World Wide Web and got over 4,000 hits.
What year was that?
This was, must have been 96 or 8. With such a wealth of information available in seconds, who in the future will be inclined to wait a couple of weeks for an information packet from a gender organization? And that's the way it worked. You found an ad somewhere, or saw someone's name on TV, you wrote them, and 3 weeks later you got a fat packet. The organizations were spending all their money to stuff those fat packets and mail them back to you, and you got a limited amount of information 3 weeks after you asked for it. And which organization will be able to afford packets sent by mail at a cost of a dollar or two apiece when a website can disperse 10 or 100 or 1,000 times as much information instantly and for free? Next slide. I just did a search. I got 6 million hits for the word transgender, and 8 million, six for transsexual and eight for transgender. 8 million hits. So maybe I was a little prescient after all. Several of the national organizations have gone by the wayside or have become primarily political. I now see IFGE as being primarily political. They've established an office in Washington, D.C. I think that's their strength now and not education. So, but imagine for a moment it's 1952 or 1985. You have a dire need for information. You have no idea how to get it. There are no books at your local library, and this is what you find at the newsstand. I apologize for the graphic nature, but that's what you saw when you went looking for information about transgender issues, at least when I was young. And you can get to the next one. So that was what you found. There might have been support groups in your town, but you couldn't find them. I couldn't find any, even in my hometown. There was a little support available, but if you got any help at all back then, it was personal. You might meet with another cross-dresser at a restaurant for screening to a support group for Tri-S, or you responded to a personal ad and you met another transsexual, or you went to one of the small gender conferences that were happening around the country, like Fantasia Fair or Dream. And let's compare to the 90s. There was more support, but it was mostly top-down. You sent a letter in and you got it back and you read it 40 times. You thumbed through Tapestry at a bookstore. Well, you bought it at a bookstore and thumbed through it till the cover fell off. I know I did. And you went to a gender conference where if you were lucky, you met some people. And if you weren't, you left still not knowing anybody or anything. You got online with your very first newspaper and you mostly read the pages from various organizations or a few personal pages. And now, over the past years, things have really started to change. Transgender support, I would argue, is once again becoming personal. Today you open a Facebook account, immediately have 250 transgender friends with whom you correspond. You Twitter all day long with your friends, or you write a blog and correspond with your readers. Next one. Or you join a virtual world like Second Life. This is the next slide too. This is the Transgender Resource Center in Second Life. I've been around for about 3 years now. Second Life is a virtual world where I spend some time. There's an avatar sitting over by the fire, and I came to take pictures, and she thought I was some kind of scared person that was afraid to come in because I was just standing outside taking pictures. And she's just exactly like I used to do with Aegis. It's like, hi, come on in. We can help you. We have all kinds of information. Next piece. So lots of people are now going to virtual worlds like Second Life, creating avatars in their target gender, and living a full and fulfilling virtual life. Next picture. Or they're meeting at support groups or at conferences and becoming friends. People are getting involved in transgender politics. Now, I had a picture here I took out. I wish I had it now because it showed Jude Patton, who's sitting right here, Sister Mary Elizabeth, Joy Schaefer, and a couple of other people involved in an ACLU advisory group. It must have been 30 years ago. But I ended up, to keep things brief here, and I wish I'd left it in, Jude. Next picture. You get involved in transgender art. Next picture. Or you run a transgender support group or attend one. Next picture. You work on transgender health issues. Next picture. You write your very own transgender education material. John Israel wrote this book on her own dime with very little formal education and made big changes with professionals with this book. And you go to transgender conferences and recharge your batteries and meet new people. You may even go to a conference like this one, but I found that picture. Most of the pictures on here, believe it or not, I scared up on the internet. Now, I've argued that as the community evolved, it began as largely personal, that by the mid-80s, it was largely controlled by national organizations, which were doing their best without adequate funds to disseminate information to growing numbers of people. A model, I contend, could not have lasted. Certainly, I couldn't have lasted. So I was looking for someone to take it over from me. But I couldn't find anyone who was as big a sucker as me, too. So I was stuck with it. And now, thanks to emerging technologies, we're now back to the personal. Everyone here can get personal support. There's still some nationals around to get information about, mostly about transgender politics these days. But, you know, we have more support now. It's personal. We can hook up instantly by typing in a word on the internet. And it's helped the community grow and become more vital. So that's a good thing, I think. Thank you for listening to me.
Sure.